Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. This is Book 3, Chapter 5, and let's jump straight in. They all separated, but except Anatole, who fell asleep as soon as he got into bed, all kept awake a long time that night. Is he really to be my husband, this stranger, who is so kind? Yes, kind, that is his chief thing, thought Princess Mary. And fear, which she had seldom experienced, came upon her. She feared to look around. It seemed to her that someone was there, standing behind the screen in the dark corner, and this someone was he, the devil, and he was also this man with the white forehead, black eyebrows, and red lips. She rang for her maid, and asked for her to sleep in her room. Mademoiselle Bourienne walked up and down the conservatory for a long time that evening, vainly expecting someone, now smiling at someone, now working herself up to tears with the imaginary words of her pauvre mère rebuking her for her fall. The little princess grumbled to her maid that her bed was barely made. She could not lie either on her face or on her side. Every position was awkward and uncomfortable, and her burden oppressed her now more than ever, because Anatole's presence had vividly recalled to her the time when she was not like that, and when everything was light and gay. She sat in an armchair in her dressing jacket and nightcap, and Katie, sleepy and dishevelled, beat and turned the heavy feather bed for the third time, muttering to herself. "I told you it was all lumps and holes," the little princess repeated. "I should be glad enough to fall asleep, so it's not my fault." And her voice quivered like that of a child about to cry. The old prince did not sleep either. Tikhon, half asleep, heard him pacing angrily about and snorting. The old prince felt as though he had been insulted through his daughter. The insult was the more pointed because it concerned not himself, but another, his daughter, whom he loved more than himself. He kept telling himself that he would consider the whole matter and decide what was right and how he should act, but instead of that he only excited himself more and more. The first man that turns up, she forgets her father and everything else, runs upstairs and does up her hair and wags her tail and is unlike herself, glad to throw her father over. And she knew I should notice it. Fr, fr, fr. And don't I see that that idiot had eyes only for Bourienne? I shall have to get rid of her. And how is it that she has not pride enough to see it? If she has no pride for herself, she might at least have some for my sake. She must be shown that the blockhead thinks nothing of her and looks only at Bourienne. No, she has no pride, but I'll let her see. The old prince knew that if he told his daughter she was making a mistake, and that Anatole meant to flirt with Mademoiselle Bourienne, Princess Mary's self-esteem would be wounded, and his point, not to be parted from her, would be gained. So, pacifying himself with this thought, he called Tikhon and began to undress. What devil brought them here, thought he, while Tikhon was putting the nightshirt over his dried-up old body and grey-haired chest. I never invited them. They came to disturb my life, and there is not much of it left. Devil take 'em, he muttered, while his head was still covered by the shirt. Tikhon knew his master's habit of sometimes thinking aloud, and therefore met with unaltered looks the angrily inquisitive expression of the face that emerged from the shirt. "Gone to bed?" asked the prince. Tikhon, like all good valets, instinctively knew the direction of his master's thoughts. He guessed that the question referred to Prince Vasily and his son. "They have gone to bed and put out their lights, Your Excellency." "No good, no good," said the prince rapidly, and thrusting his feet into his slippers and his arms into the sleeves of his dressing gown, he went to the couch on which he slept. Though no words had passed between Anatole and Mademoiselle Bourienne, they quite understood one another as to the first part of their romance, up to the appearance of the pauvre mère. They understood that they had much to say to one another in private, and so they had been seeking an opportunity since morning to meet one another alone. When Princess Mary went to her father's room at the usual hour, Mademoiselle Bourienne and Anatole met in the conservatory. Princess Mary went to the door of the study with special trepidation. It seemed to her that not only did everybody know that her fate would be decided that day, but that they had also knew what she thought about it. She read this in Tikhon's face and in that of Prince Vasily's valet, who made her low bow when she met him in the corridor carrying hot water. The old prince was very affectionate and careful in his treatment of his daughter that morning. Princess Mary well knew this painstaking expression of her father's. His face wore that expression when his dry hands clenched with vexation at her not understanding a sum in arithmetic, when rising from his chair he would walk away from her repeating in a low voice the same words several times over. He came to the point at once, treating her ceremoniously. "I have had a proposition made me concerning you," he said with an unnatural smile. "I expect you have guessed that Prince Vasily has not come and brought his pupil with him." For some reason, Prince Bolkonski referred to Anatole as a pupil. "For the sake of my beautiful eyes, last night a proposition was made on your account, and, as you know my principles, I refer it to you." "How am I to understand you, mon père?" said the princess, growing pale and then blushing. "How to understand me?" cried her father angrily. "Prince Vasily finds you to his taste as a daughter-in-law and makes a proposal to you on his pupil's behalf. That's how it's to be understood. How understand it, and I ask you." "I do not know what you think, father," whispered the princess. I? What of me? Leave me out of the question. I'm not going to get married. What about you? That's what I want to know." The princess saw that her father regarded the matter with disapproval, but at that moment the thought occurred to her that her fate would be decided now or never. She lowered her eyes so as not to see the gaze under which she felt that she could not think, but would be only able to submit from habit, and she said, "I wish only to do your will, but if I had to express my own desire..." She had no time to finish. The old prince interrupted her. "That's admirable," he shouted. "He will take you with your dowry and make Mademoiselle Bourienne into the bargain. She'll be the wife, while you..." The prince stopped. He saw the effect these words had produced on his daughter. She lowered her head and was ready to burst into tears. Now then, I'm only joking," he said. "Remember this, princess. I hold to the principle that a maiden has a full right to choose. I give you freedom. Only remember that your life's happiness depends on your decision. Never mind me." "But I do not know, father." "There's no need to talk. He receives his orders and will marry you or anybody, but you are free to choose. Go to your room, think it over, and come back in an hour and tell me in his presence, yes or no. I know you will pray over it. Well, pray if you like, but you had better think it over. Go, yes or no, yes or no, yes or no." He still shouted when the princess, as if lost in a fog, had already staggered out of the study. Her fate was decided, and happily decided. But what her father had said about Mademoiselle Bourienne was dreadful. It was untrue, to be sure, but still it was terrible, and she could not help thinking of it. She was going straight on through the conservatory, neither seeing nor hearing anything, when suddenly the well-known whispering of Mademoiselle Bourienne aroused her. She raised her eyes and, two steps away, saw Anatole embracing the Frenchwoman and whispering something to her. With a horrified expression on his handsome face, Anatole looked at Princess Mary, but did not at once take his arm from the waist of Mademoiselle Bourienne, who had not yet seen her. "Who's that? Why, wait a minute," Anatole's face seemed to say. Princess Mary looked at them in silence. She could not understand it. At last, Mademoiselle Bourienne gave a scream and ran away. Anatole bowed to Princess Mary with a gay smile, as if inviting her to join in a laugh at this strange incident, and then, shrugging his shoulders, went to the door that led to his own apartments. An hour later, Tikhon came to call Princess Mary to the old prince. He added that Prince Vasily was also there. When Tikhon came to her, Princess Mary was sitting on the sofa in her room, holding the weeping Mademoiselle Bourienne in her arms, and gently stroking her hair. The princess's beautiful eyes, with all their former calm radiance, were looking with tender affection and pity at Mademoiselle Bourienne's pretty face. "No, princess, I have lost your affection forever," said Mademoiselle Bourienne. "Why, I love you more than ever," said Princess Mary, "and I will try to do all I can for your happiness." "But you despise me. You, who are so pure, can never understand being so carried away by passion. Oh, only my poor mother. I quite understand, answered Princess Mary with a sad smile. Calm yourself, my dear. I will go to my father, she said, and went out. Prince Vasily, with one leg thrown over the other and a snuff-box in his hand, was sitting there with a smile of deep emotion on his face, as if stirred to his heart's core and himself regretting and laughing at his own sensibility, when Princess Mary entered. He hurriedly took a pinch of snuff. "Oh, my dear," he began, rising and taking her by both hands. Then, sighing, he added, "My son's fate is in your hands. Decide, my dear, good gentle Marie, whom I have always loved as a daughter." He drew back, and a real tear appeared in his eye. "For," snorted Prince Bolkonski. "The prince is making a proposition to you in his pupil's, I mean his son's, name. Do you wish or not to be Prince Anatoly Kurágin's wife? Reply yes or no," he shouted, "and then I shall reserve the right to state my opinion also. Yes, my opinion, and only my opinion," added Prince Bolkonski, turning to Prince Vasily and answering his imploring look. "Yes or no?" "My desire is never to leave you, father, never to separate my life from yours. I don't wish to marry," she answered positively, glancing at Prince Vasily and at her father with her beautiful eyes. "Humbug, nonsense, humbug, humbug, humbug," cried Prince Bolkonski, frowning. And, taking his daughter's hand, he did not kiss her, but only bending his forehead to hers, just touched it, and pressed her hand so that she winced and uttered a cry. Prince Vasily rose. "My dear, I must tell you that this is a moment I shall never, never forget. But, my dear, will you not give us a little hope of touching his heart? So kind and generous. Say, perhaps. The future is so long. Say, perhaps." "Prince, what I have said is all there is in my heart. I thank you for the honour, but I shall never be your son's wife." "Well, so that's finished, my dear fellow. I am very glad to have seen you, very glad. Go back to your rooms, princess, go," said the old prince. "Very, very glad to have seen you," repeated he, embracing Prince Vasily. "My vocation is a different one," thought Princess Mary. "My vocation is to be happy with another kind of happiness, the happiness of love and self-sacrifice. And, cost what it may, I will arrange poor Emily's happiness. She loves him so passionately, and so passionately repents. I will do all I can to arrange the match between them. If he is not rich, I will give her the means. I will ask my father and Andrew. I shall be so happy when she is his wife. She is so unfortunate, a stranger, alone, helpless, and, oh God, how passionately she loves him. If she could go so far to forget herself. Perhaps I might have done the same," thought Princess Mary. All right, there we have it, another chapter down. And how tough is Mary, Princess Maya? She really wears a lot of hurtful betrayals in this chapter and responds to them with kindness, instinctive kindness, which... At first I read her as someone who had very, very low self-esteem, so she kind of just rolled over. She let people walk all over her. But now I'm just starting to see it as maybe more of a strength of character. She's tough. I'm still not sure, though. Her father, old Bolkonski, is really nasty to her in this chapter, reduces her to tears. But she comes back to him and kind of reassures him. She recognizes that that's his insecurity causing him to be angry, and so she soothes that insecurity. And of course, Mademoiselle Bourienne betrays her by hooking up with the guy that, you know, hours before she was fantasizing about marrying. Her best friend, so to speak, has now gone behind her back and hooked up, and she's caught them in the act. And then, you know, not long later, she's there consoling Mademoiselle Bourienne and saying she's going to do everything in her power to help them get married if that's what they want. Not until this chapter did I think that I wanted to see more of this character, Princess Maya. But now I kind of do. I want to see how she pans out, what happens here with her. Reddit user Neurotransmissions said, "I like that Nikolai Bolkonski lets his daughter choose whether or not she wishes to marry Anatole. In my opinion, the education he has strived to provide for her and his desire to wish to keep her with him outside of marriage, whether selfishly for his own enjoyment of her company, or selflessly believing that marriage will bring her unhappiness, indicates a great deal of respect for her as a person. He goes so far to state that Vasily will make his own son do as Vasily wants. If Vasily tells Anatole he's going to marry someone, then Anatole will just show up and marry that person. In complete contrast, Maya gets to choose. Maybe Tolstoy is trying to highlight the difference in these characters. Maya has a less attractive exterior and a beautiful inner person which is reflected in the window to her soul, her eyes. Anatole is kind of an idiot, and because he is attractive and has a fairly cool attitude, he gets away with it. That she encounters Anatole and Mademoiselle Bourienne in romantic embrace really continues to illuminate the contrast in these characters. She sees this and thinks, wow, my best friend must be really in love with this man for this to have happened. How can I make my best friend happy with my current position? And Anatole sees the whole thing as, well, I might have to marry Maya, but at least there is this attractive French lady who will come along with her. Which is super heartbreaking. Maya chooses to spend the rest of her life in service to others' happiness, and she is at peace with that. That is such a noble and idealist thought. I am so worried about her as a character and how this might come back to her and cause her more pain, especially if she were to ever realize that the love she is feeling towards others and the sacrifice this love is compelling her to perform would not be done in return. It is a bit heartbreaking, and you worry that that attitude, although it is noble and idealistic, it isn't sustainable. I think you need to sometimes stand your ground in order for those other people to realize that they might be taking advantage of you. That's my worry with her. She might let other people take advantage of her kindness. And I think deep down people don't want to take advantage of kindness, but if you let them, they'll do it. But conversely, sometimes when you pull them up on it, they're actually, in a weird way, grateful to have been pulled up on it. And so I think she needs to learn to stand her ground a little bit just to, you know, keep people in check. People like being kept in check. People don't like being able to get away with anything. But saying that, I do really admire her ability to handle any situation without spite or without bitterness. Even ones, you know, even betrayal is if anything, is going to stir up some bitterness in you. It's being betrayed. It's really hard to suppress an impulse to become, you know, angry at someone when they betray you. So I kind of envy that skill, that patience that she has, and I wish I had more of that. I think a lot of the readers are thinking along the same lines. There's quite a bit of admiration for Maya in the comments. Reddit user Rusifi said, "This chapter was just heartbreaking. Maya so clearly yearns for any relationship that is openly affectionate and caring. While her father loves her, he is abrasive and often cruel. He can't or won't express his love for her and his desire for her to make a decision that will make her happy, but also his potential loneliness without her. Then her best friend hooks up with the man she's hanging all her hopes on. Granted, Anatole is basically a dope, the only one who can sleep easy because there's nothing going on in his head. His laughing after Maya finds him and Mademoiselle Bourienne in the garden was particularly obnoxious. But still, it's a truly generous person who will see the best in another person even after they've been betrayed. She ends up comforting Mademoiselle Bourienne, who knows that she really messed up. I just feel bad for Maya. I hope she finds someone who will care for her by the end of the book." Quidiset responded to this saying, "I share your hope for her. It's very clear that she loves and respects her father, and it's pretty clear, I think, that he loves and dotes on her in his own peculiar way. But it seems pretty clear that neither is capable of expressing these feelings in a way that the other recognizes as such an expression, and that is a bit heartbreaking." Heartbreaking is the theme of these two's relationship, isn't it? And I've got this deep fear that, you know, when some people just have the tragic side of a story and you hope the best for them and they deserve the best, and that's the character that the author chooses to just punish, you know. That's where they put all the tragedy. The best people, the most deserving people, end up having the worst thing happen to them. You see it all the time in literature and stories. Part of me would make that prediction that that's going to happen to Maya, but a bigger part of me doesn't want that to happen. I want her to have a happy ending. I guess it depends if Tolstoy was in a good mood or not when he wrote her parts. It was another good chapter. These last two or so chapters have been really well written and really easy to read. A few chapters ago, I complained that the writing was just too messy and convoluted and confusing. And I had a lot of sentences that I had to read over again because I just had the complete wrong inflection and there was no way to infer the correct inflection on first reading just because of lack of punctuation and the convolutedness of the sentences. It got to the point where at the moment I'm editing a novel that I'm working on, and I always, one of my goals in editing is to make sure that every sentence is in the book can be read correctly the first time you read it. I don't like when you have to go back and reread a sentence because you realize you were reading it with the wrong inflection. I bring this up because recently I edit my books with pen and paper. I print them and I get a red pen and I put notes all the way through it, and then I put those edits in later. I'm in the red penning stage. And so whenever I notice a sentence that I read incorrectly the first time and had to, you know, and flagged it for rework, the code word that I'd use to flag that was the problem is now Tolstoyed. I Tolstoyed myself. So it's become such a hallmark of this book that I read these sentences incorrectly that now the phenomenon of reading a sentence with the wrong inflection is now in my mind called Tolstoying a sentence. That does not bode well for this author. I think it might be a translation problem. I don't think it's probably the same in every translation of this book. I think the thing that's happened is because the Maud translation is the closest to Russian and they've tried to keep the Russian sentence structure in place. And Tolstoy was taking advantage of a trick of the Russian syntax that allowed for really complex sentences. When translated into English, I think that trick falls apart a bit and they become a little bit unreadable. And I think therein lies the problem. I'm no expert, but that's my best take on it. Anyway, these last couple of chapters, I haven't Tolstoyed up any sentences. I've been able to basically nail them all first time. So that's been really nice. A quick thanks to those who have shared the podcast. I have noticed a little bump in users again. Yesterday I had about 180 listens, which was, about 50 more than the usual average. So I was really quite pleased to see that. Thanks very much for sharing it. And please continue to share it with your friends and family and your Facebook groups and that kind of thing. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.